Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Paul Martin is a psychologist who'll be in Sydney in the next week to take a workshop on understanding sexual diversity. Paul Martin comes with an interesting history. He grew up as an evangelical Christian, went through the Exodus program to help people come to terms with their sexuality and perhaps get over their homosexuality, and has latterly come to a point of understanding that it's a much more complex issue. And these days, he is helping people with their own struggles in that area. Paul Martin, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you, John.
What sorts of things are you going to be talking about at the Understanding Sexual Diversity workshop this week?
Well, it's really about getting Christians to understand the reality of what it's like to be same-sex attracted. So that means gay, lesbian, bisexual, curious, men who have sex with men, etc. Because so often there is a lot of talk about theology and about morals and all those sorts of things. I actually train psychologists to understand people who are same-sex attracted, because even people who are really well-trained professionals don't understand. And unfortunately, what I've seen over the years is that Christians just don't have access to the research, to literature, to science, to psychology, to really understand the reality of same-sex attraction. So whenever the church attempts, and I think a lot of times it's well-meaning, they want to do the right thing by these people, but unfortunately they usually get it wrong. And the amount of psychological carnage I've seen over the years with people who've been deeply affected by the church is devastating, and it becomes like a mutually exclusive thing where they're either Christian or they're gay, and because they're gay and there's nothing you can do about it, it's like going from white to black, you just can't do it. They therefore feel they've got to reject their faith. So there's many, many thousands of people who are deeply psychologically damaged by the sorts of well-meaning things that the church has been trying to do, and they've lost their faith.
The way the evangelical churches in particular tried to come to terms with this discussion over the years was to set up groups such as Exodus International, and Exodus International claimed to be able to cure homosexuality or sexual orientation, that it treated it as a disease, or as the Pope says, a sort of disorder, and that was an objective disorder that could be overcome. So it tended to approach it as a theological question first, that is it a sin or not a sin? Once it decided that, then automatically, irrespective of anything else, it had to be a disorder which was curable.
That's one of the big problems there, John, that it is only seen as a theological issue, and it's seen in a very kind of 1950s psychological way as being a disorder which is based on damage that was done to you as a child through having a same-sex love deficit from a parent of the same sex. So what happens is that problem that you have that leads to same-sex orientation, that can be cured. You can have really good, intimate, non-sexual relationships with people of the same sex, and that will heal those wounds that happened to you as a child, and you will gradually move towards the fullness of your true heterosexuality, which God intended.
It's also compounded by images and stereotypes established. And I guess that's changed somewhat. That is, the images and stereotypes that many people in churches grew up with in the 60s and 70s was the dirty old man at the public toilet, that sort of image. So that the stereotypical image that people struggling with sexual identity were challenged with, particularly out of churches, was either the dirty old man in the public toilet or the mincing queen.
That's right, exactly. And there's this predatory aspect to being gay. When I was growing up in the 70s, there was Are You Being Served? He was one of the gay characters. I think even Dr. Smith from Lost in Space was the other one that no one really talked about. So they weren't the best role models. These days we've got football players, rugby players that have come out and are great role models. But I certainly didn't have that. And for me as a young boy growing up, I was listening to these things in church, about these terrible, disgusting people. And I just hated them. I thought, oh my God, they had really horrific kind of race of disturbed and disordered people. So the horror and trauma that I had when I started to realize that I was only attracted to people of the same sex was just probably the worst experience of my life. It's like being in a car accident, the survivor of a horrible car accident.
The pain associated with this in the Christian journey is a particularly difficult one. Give us examples of the sorts of people who confront you today coming out of a Christian background and wanting to come to terms with an identity that they find extraordinarily challenging.
Clients of mine range all the way from their kind of late teens to their, you know, late 70s. And for example, a client of mine in his late 70s who went through the Baptist Church, was actually a leader in the Baptist Church for many years, and basically dedicated his life to serving the Lord, in his words. And he knew he was gay and knew that theologically, in terms of what they were talking about, that it was wrong. So he did absolutely everything in his power to not be gay, including, you know, he was advised to get married, which he did. He was advised by his Christian psychiatrist to go through aversion therapy, where he was electrocuted when he was seeing images of, or was aroused through images of males. And then it goes all the way to young teenagers who are still going through internal conflict regarding a fundamentalist or a sort of literal interpretation of the Bible type of framework. So there's quite a broad range of people that I would see.
Paul Martin, we're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia via Radio Australia and through the web to the world. We're talking about understanding sexual diversity, particularly in the context of a religious community. Paul Martin, take us now through some of your own personal journey. You grew up in a conservative evangelical church. We've already mentioned the stereotypes that are around in those days. When did you first become aware of your own sexual identity, and in what context, particularly with regard to the church?
Yes, well, having spent endless Sunday mornings listening to the horrors of homosexuality, and then when I realized that my sexual fantasy life was primarily made up, and in fact eventually exclusively made up of other males, it was incredibly traumatic. And I remember it felt like I was being hit by a sledgehammer. It was just really, really distressing. And there was a sense of being hopeless, that there's nothing that could be done about it. And that's, I think, what led to quite a deep depression at that time.
How old were you?
I would have been about 13 or 14 at that stage. And, of course, there's no way I could have told anyone because of the huge amount of shame and distress that I was feeling. So it's the most isolating experience I think anyone could almost ever have.
It's because you're in a church context, and for those people who aren't operating in church contexts, it's not just that you don't talk about it, it is that many churches have very specific prohibitions on gay behaviour, more so than on almost any other form of misbehaviour, if you want to even categorise it in those terms.
Yes, that's right. I mean, rather than seeing sexuality as an extension of love, when I was growing up, the churches were saying that sexuality for gay men is an extension of their perversion. So any sexual behaviour was an act that was an abomination to God. It was a terrible, sinful act. And if you ever did it, that it's such a horrific sin, probably one of the worst sins you could ever commit. And the other thing was this terror, blinding terror of ending up rotting in hell permanently. So I just pretended to be something different. And for those who have come out in different church settings, they are excluded from so many of the ways that they would like to serve God.
So it amplifies the repression problem.
It really does. It just what it does do is it encourages people to live a secret life. And so quite often people will get married and they end up having two lives, because sexuality, your love for your partner, everybody's love for their partner is so strong. And if you are single and you're a sexual being, which most of us are, trying to not be sexual and trying not to express or have a drive towards being loved and to love is like holding a ball underwater. And unfortunately, what I've seen over the years is that a lot of gay Christians end up living a secret life and end up living a life that's so opposite to their Christian values. because they're not able to marry. Their relationships and sexual acts are seen as perversions. Of course, you know, they eventually do have sex with other people, and it encourages this kind of very seedy, you know, very casual sex-oriented life, as opposed to a life that's consistent with their values, according to, you know, God's desire for us to love and be loved.
You went through a particularly difficult period because at the time that you decided that you had to come out as gay, your own family went through a trauma that's probably unusual, and perhaps you should describe it for
us. Yes. It was a little bit histrionic. My father beat me to it. Like, I was thinking about maybe I need to come out. This is when I was sort of late teens, and my father beat me to it, you know, by weeks, I think, but came out in a way that was very typical of a lot of gay married men who subjugate themselves, and when they finally come out, it's such a dramatic coming out that they're like somebody different. So it was a flurry of, this is the early 80s, you know, raw silk and pastel colours, and he lost his, you know, businessman's gut and started to have these wild parties, and my mother was deeply traumatised and the whole family was falling apart.
And this is a very conservative, straight family. I mean, this is not...
Yes.
You could be described as very middle-class successful.
Yes. Well, I was sort of brought up in an old Bentley talking about... my father talking about, you know, the importance of the royal family and how terrible unions are. And so I was sort of brought up in that context. And the Christianity was very much an extension of that. You know, the Liberal Party, and we're Christians, of course, and Baptists and eventually evangelicals. And so it was very much that scene. So for my father to come out in that scene, it wasn't as though they were hippies. I mean, it was just so traumatic for my mother. And when I saw my mother going through it, I thought, oh, my God, literally. I couldn't possibly do that to her on top of what's happened, or she'll end up, you know, suiciding or something.
So you approach this when you come out, and as you've said, you go to Exodus as eventually as a group who may be able to help you. Exodus International provide you with a therapeutic regime. Yet that therapeutic regime for you took on many of the aspects that you would these days describe as most damaging.
It was really awful because a lot of the things, there were tapes, there was prayer therapy, there was getting demons out, there was, you know, you name it, it happened. And the thing is that it's just you have to persist and believe in the miracles of Christ and all those sorts of things and the healing hand of God. And if you persist and you keep going, it will happen. But unfortunately what happens is you just keep failing. Because as I said before, it's like you're white and you want to become black. No matter how hard you try, your skin colour will always be the same. It's just so deeply imprinted, just part of the natural human diversity. It's just who I am and who I'll always be. At that stage, it was just so traumatic, day after day after day, hoping that this time another tape, another counselling session, another prayer, another miracle I'm hoping for will change my orientation. So finally, I'll be able to be a success story that we used to parade around the place.
You were working with others in Exodus International, though.
Yes, I was supporting people. At that stage, I really was I was in my early 20s, so, and I hadn't had any psychological training at that stage. So we had support groups, you know, where people would talk about when they had sex with someone, they just fell that week, and we'd sort of support them through the trauma of that and help them not do it again and those sorts of things.
So how many people were you working with, and did you take on any form of leadership role in the Exodus International operation?
I was the co-leader of the Melbourne chapter of Exodus International for a couple of years, and my co-leader is now in a long-term lesbian relationship, Wendy Lawson, who's a lovely friend of mine. And so we both co-led Exodus at that stage, and both at the same time left Exodus as well.
Well, you must have sincerely believed it at that time.
I absolutely did.
So it had success for you, or at least...
Well, I'm a very optimistic person, and so I just was so optimistic about it because there was a psychological theory. This Elizabeth Mobley, a neo-Freudian, said it was because of a same-sex love deficit, and if you have good, solid, healthy, non-sexual relationships with people of the same gender, plus you get prayer therapy. And there were these tapes, like every time you were fantasizing about a man, you'd suddenly imagine a stop sign, and of course all I did was think, oh my God, I hope I never get attracted to stop signs. That would not be a good outcome. They're very uncomfortable. From what I've heard. So crazy stuff like that, you know, stuff that, you know, for example, if you were or any of the listeners who are heterosexual and went to a group to try and be gay, it's just so bizarre, really, when I look at it now.
At what point did you decide this is not for me or this is not working? And did you decide that with others? And the subset of that is, did this also lead to a crisis in faith?
It absolutely did. And in fact, because so much of this was based on a literal interpretation of the Bible or a fundamentalist Christian framework, I went to Thailand and spent some time there and just fell in love with the place and the beauty of the people and the culture and everything. And when I was flying out of there, I suddenly burst into tears and realized that according to what I believe, that 97% of these people are going straight to hell after they die. And that for me, just everything suddenly melted away. And I went back to Melbourne and said to my co-leader, Wendy, I said, look, I just can't do this anymore. It is not working. It doesn't make sense. I've tried so hard with my blood, sweat and tears. We've all tried so hard. So Paul, independently, without you knowing, I've come to this exact same conclusion. And we came to the same conclusion on the same day, which was quite strange. That unfortunately just doesn't work.
What did you say to other people who in Exodus International at that time, and particularly those people you were working with?
Unfortunately and very sadly, I think a lot of Christian organisations, if you leave them, the response is one of they just shut down in a way. The shutters come down, dialogue ceases, and you're one of them. You know, you're kind of someone who's betrayed.
You're shunned as a betrayer.
Yes, yeah. That's right. And so unfortunately I lost some very good friends out of that. And,
just the day itself or those couple of days, did you speak to other people or did
yes,
you
I
just
did.
Ring up somebody and say, sorry, I'm not coming in today?
So I'm over it. I did. I tried to, once I told one person, other people knew about it and they were very, very distressed. And it was like, you know, when one of the leaders, which has happened many times, obviously, over the years, that when one of the leaders of Exodus, you know, comes out publicly and says that it doesn't work and that, you know, it's a terrible thing, that I think there's a natural defense there because these people do feel they're doing the right thing. And there are a lot of people that get married as a result of being in Exodus and unfortunately, again, live split lives, some of them. And so there's a lot of defenses up there to make sure that it looks as though it actually still works.
And what about the faith dimension? Was there a simultaneous crisis of faith or did that underneath not really alter?
No, I think that was a big thing for me, that that I then, you know, the whole cards were just sort of thrown all over the place and I had to kind of then try and live and grieve in a way over the loss of faith, because the faith that I'd been brought up with had really tortured me over the years and I couldn't see any good at all coming out of it, and I just found it was really hypocritical and damaging, and it continues unfortunately to damage so many people, and it's taken so many years to rethink all of that. But at the time it was a real crisis of faith. And I just couldn't possibly see myself living as a Christian ever again.
So it meant cutting yourself off from a church community as well?
Yes, it did. And I remember there was one guy, even when I was questioning my sexuality at one stage, and I said, look, I'm not sure if it is so bad to be gay. And he was like a brother to me. He was one of these people that I was having a good, healthy, non-sexual relationship with. And he went to his pastor and came back to me and said, look, because you're questioning this, I've been told by my pastor to reject you in the name of Jesus. And that was pretty explicit, but basically that pardon me, that theme happened, you know, so many times. It was really very devastating.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest is psychologist Paul Martin, telling us of his journey and his work with the Centre for Human Potential on Understanding Sexual Diversity. Paul Martin, you've taken us through the very difficult journey of coming to terms with your own sexuality, but facing the prospect of losing your faith. How did you begin to put it back together again?
Well, you know, I'm talking about 20 years worth of trying to put it back together, John. It's been quite an arduous journey, and I'm not sure I'm there, to be honest. I'm really, but it was interesting. I spoke at a place called A Different Conversation. A guy called Zach Turner in Sydney, who's been trying to get Christians to rethink sexual diversity from a faith perspective. And it was only when I was there as an expert speaker on one of their panels and listening to these beautiful people, and there was a guy there who was like the pastor of the police force in Sydney, and he was just saying, look, God is love. How can we tell gay and lesbian people that their love is sinful, their love is disordered? And I just saw so many people in that context, in that particular forum, that made me rethink about Christianity. So, you know, on one hand, I think, you know, if God exists, he's doing a bloody good job of trying to get me back, because I'm now suddenly confronted by these beautiful people who aren't doing the hell and brimstone, you're disordered, sick and terrible, that these people are actually talking about love, finally.
It's an interesting one, and I guess for many people in the churches these days, it's thrown into relief by the whole argument that's raged on the political surface about gay marriage.
Yes.
Because there's a sense in which marriage is the ultimate symbol of fidelity, yet this is the one thing that many Christians say they want gay people to do, that is to be faithful to each other and stop living a promiscuous lifestyle. Something of a paradox there.
That's a very, very, very important point. Paradoxically, by Christians saying, you know, gay people can't get married, they unfortunately encourage gay people to live a life of meaningless casual sex. For example, with my partner, I'd love to be able to get married because we hold very close to our heart ideals and values, which are very much conservative Christian values of family and real unconditional love, etc. And to be married is probably the most conservative thing I could ever do, which surprises me when I look back at my life. I never perceived myself as conservative. So unfortunately, when the church says that, you know, homosexuality disorder, that gay and lesbian people should not be married, one of the other problems is it sends a very deep message through to so many gay and lesbian people, and particularly young people. I had a very young guy in the practice yesterday who looked at me in tears, and was very, very depressed, and said, look, why won't they let us marry? I'm not a second-rate citizen. I'm trying to see myself as a good person, and I can't because people don't even want to let me get married. And I think it is so sad that well-meaning Christians just don't have the right information. They just don't understand. And this is a real problem.
It's been played out on both sides, though. I guess one of the problems is context. That is, when gay liberation emerges in the 70s and in the 80s, it's often associated with the celebration of sensuality. That is similar to but different from culturally. There were two cultural battles going on, and they get confused. The gay culture side, it was as much about celebrating liberation.
That's right. Yes. And it's interesting, John, it's a very good point, because when you look at that from, as you say, almost like a sociological perspective, it's like a whole, like thousands and millions of people, and what with the way, you know, it was a crime, it was a disorder, it was sick and perverted, etc., that they then couldn't express themselves. So it's like, again, holding a ball underwater. And so when that ball comes up, it's this dramatic kind of overwhelming sort of thing. And everyone's like, my God, what the hell's that? And I think it is great that gay and lesbian people are able to celebrate diversity. There's a lot of diversity in gay and lesbian subcultures, which is really colourful and wonderful. And there are some people, and I'm, you know, myself really, I think, very much is, I guess, more in touch with the, you know, wanting a family and wanting to get married and having those very sort of traditional, I guess, values. And a lot of people don't want to live according to those values, and they want to live their own lives, which is great. I mean, there is a real sense of diversity. And that expression, I think, particularly in the 70s and 80s, et cetera, was so over the top. I think it was like people had been repressing themselves for so long, it came out in a very colourful way.
There's a tension then, as there is in all areas of sexual expression, between the desire for sort of liberal carnality and the desire for fidelity. Now, in the sort of heterosexual field of life, young people traditionally said, well, you know, you've got all these desires, but ultimately it's good to be channeled into a steady way of life that does honour to each side of a relationship.
Yes.
The magic word is fidelity here.
Yes.
Is that a word that now works in gay culture? That is, it's a word that has to be struggled with and thought about.
It's a word that is struggled with and thought about, and the reason that is the case is because I think men are men, and a lot of gay couples actually find that they can, if they've got a very good, healthy relationship, as long as it's being talked about openly and that it's very detailed in terms of what people can and can't do, that there are quite a few couples that I know of who do that quite successfully, even though it would go against the traditional sense of values in terms of fidelity. But I think when it's talked about, when it's a sense of honesty, in a lot of cases it can actually work. For many other people, that isn't what reflects their values. You know, they are very, very clear about the need for fidelity in their lives, and they pursue that.
And that opens up then the whole area of then how in a gay community one can approach those traditional Christian values, because at the heart of that is a sense of fidelity and integrity to do with monogamy, or serial monogamy at least. So that the discussion held at that level can be a far more honest and open, and a discussion that does open up a legitimate Christian pathway.
That's right, absolutely. And a lot of people yearn for that, and it is possible. And I think one of the things that is a little bit different in terms of being part of a gay community is there is this level of honesty and transparency about those sorts of issues. And there are some really good, healthy debates around that. But I think it does come down to personal choice and what works for the actual person, rather than it being a sort of one-size-fits-all type of approach.
Well, as every religious tradition would suggest, you know,
ultimately
the pathway is for you to commit yourself to.
Yes.
You're on Sunday Nights on ABC Radio. Our guest is psychologist Paul Martin. Paul, what we haven't discussed is those who find the difficulty of not just being straight or gay, but those who find themselves in some sort of continuing confusion over the issue. And your workshops, Understanding Sexual Diversity, are as much about those who find themselves in between or extreme ends of this. Your observations to those people, and you've mentioned people like chaplains from churches or pastors from police forces or whatever. How do you talk to people through those issues, and what are the sorts of advice you give as a psychologist to people wanting to work through those issues, not from the point of view of necessarily being in the midst of them themselves, but those who want to work honestly with those who find those issues?
Yes, that's a good point, absolutely. Yes, very much so. And this is what the workshop's really targeted towards, is giving people a real understanding. A lot of people who are well-meaning, fantastic chaplains and pastors and church workers and other Christians who are there to support other people, they think they understand about same-sex attraction, and they get a very strong sense that they are really clear about that. Unfortunately, it isn't the case. And as I was saying before, I actually train psychologists, and a lot of psychologists don't understand a lot about the intricacies of the psychology behind same-sex attraction. And so when people really start to understand at a much deeper level, what are the developmental and psychological underpinning kind of deeper level dynamics that go on, it makes the work much easier because they know where the person's at. They get a much clearer sense as to what's going on for the person they're trying to support. And it makes the world of difference because so many people struggle because they don't understand. They think that they've read a book, but the book may not be legitimate. It may not be based on research and theory that actually is real. And there are a lot of people struggling out there in terms of, well, what do we do with these people? They're really a population that is much more likely to suicide, much more likely to take illicit drugs and have alcohol problems and engage in unsafe sex and be depressed and et cetera, et cetera. So how do we work with these people who are at risk of so many different mental and physical health outcomes?
Let's get a definition here too. Sexually diverse, what does it mean really? What are the range of diversities that you would typically describe to people in a
that's
workshop?
That's a really important question, because people think it's just gay or straight or whatever. It's this binary kind of system. In fact, it's not. There's an incredible diversity. So there are actually, for example, a lot of straight men who have sex with other men but are not gay. And people think, well, that doesn't make sense. But men can, a lot of men can actually separate out sexuality from who they are. And having sex with a man is obviously very different to having sex with a female. And the problem with that is that they're not really open to a lot of the safer sex messages that would help them protect themselves against sexual diseases, etc. And there are people who are genuinely bisexual. And unfortunately, this is another group of people that really suffer because it's a genuine orientation. So when they're with a same-sex partner, they're accepted by the gay and lesbian community. When they're with an opposite-sex partner, they're rejected by the gay and lesbian community and accepted by the straight community. So people don't actually believe that bisexual people are actually, they think, oh no, they're just lying to themselves or they're just playing around or whatever. And so they actually they're even more depressed and even more likely to suicide, etc., than gay or lesbian people.
And the range of behaviours in between, the transvestitism, those sorts of things as well.
Gender diversity, yeah. Again, there's a massive diversity there. And it is a genetic thing. It's just that it's not a disorder.
It's not just game playing.
It's not game playing. It's very real. And gender diversity is that it's not just male, female. There is this incredible rich diversity in between, and people don't understand that, and they're scared of it. I mean, it's because it's weird to them. It's just so, in their mind, unnatural and disordered. But it's, again, part of the rich diversity of just what it's like to be human.
I guess the reason why people coming from a traditional background seek to impose some moral order on this is because sexuality, for all of human history up until, say, the last 30 years, has been deeply enmeshed with legal codes, with codes of inheritance, with the very nature of the family, the protection of women and children and innocence, that these are very deep and difficult issues to come to terms with, because they involve not only things that are deeply, viscerally personal, but also things which are broadly cultural and legal.
Yes. No, that's absolutely correct. And I totally understand why the church wants to have, you know, very black and white moral codes. Actually, one of the books I read that meant the world to me was a guy called, and you probably heard of him, Dr. Bishop Spong, Shelby Spong, and it was a book called Living in Sin. And he talks about the things that I've been saying in terms of, you know, same-sex attraction isn't a disorder, isn't a sin. And he actually calls for gay and lesbian people to have monogamous long-term relationships in the Christian tradition, and says that those relationships are legitimate and should be supported by the church. So I think that it absolutely makes sense that the church would be thinking that way, and I totally understand that. And again, I think there is this rich diversity of people, and some people will fit beautifully into that. And I'm hoping one day that the church will be much more kind of understanding of these issues. It may or may not happen, but I'm hoping it will eventually.
Paul Martin, we're rapidly coming to the end of our time, but you're somebody who's seen this debate develop enormously over the last 30 years. You now find yourself speaking to church people that you wouldn't have spoken to in these terms 10 years ago, or even perhaps 5 years ago. Where are you seeing change, and do you find the change is giving you more cause for optimism, or are you still somebody who says, oh, this has got a long way to go?
Look, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I certainly do think it has a long way to go, absolutely. These beliefs are so deeply held, and so many people reject gay and lesbian people because they're scared of them and think they're perverted, etc. But look, I cannot tell you how surreal it was when I was sitting in Sydney as an expert panel guest talking to a bunch of Christian leaders about these sorts of issues. It was one of the most surreal moments in my life. I thought, I can't believe that it's come full circle. Here I am in this space again, but from a very different angle. Now, these people are very conservative, Anglican, Pentecostal, the whole range of different styles or forms of Christianity, and all of them were really wanting to understand sexual diversity and really wanting to see it from a much more real and loving perspective. And the way that these people were talking, I just thought, wow, look how far we've come. It's very much like, I think, if you were a black person or a woman, you know, when you couldn't vote, or you're a black person, you weren't perceived as being a citizen. It's like being back in those days in this particular particular area. And I think in 10, 20 years' time, there'll be massive changes. But at the moment, it's a little bit like we're on the frontier, you know, of this sort of thing. And I just think it's so wonderful for people to actually be talking about it and looking at it from more the honest truth and the psychology and the literature and what's reality as opposed to what so many Christians have been taught over the years, which may or may not be consistent with the truth.
The other thing that's interesting about this is that the truth seems to be emerging from the bottom up rather than the top down.
The
sort of arcane theological debates being put to one side, and people are saying, this is my experience on the ground.
That's
living
right.
And working with people.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think it's people like myself who talk to other, you know, or talk to Christians about my personal experience, and when they start to really understand it, then they can actually think, okay, so what is the truth, you know, and have I got it wrong, have I got it right? And I'm not saying anything about people's theology or anything like that. It's much more about just people looking at it from different angles and coming to their own conclusions based on their own faith perspective.
So when people turn up at a workshop next week, what are they going to be subject to? What will they expect to hear?
Well, it'll be an interesting journey. We'll be talking about the ex-gay movement, some of the psychological dynamics that can happen through that, why some people seem to be quite successful and some people are successful, and what happens to the people that are not. What does concealable stigma mean? What's it like? What is the psychological damage that occurs to someone when they're growing up having secrets like this? And how can you work in a loving way, no matter what your theological perspective, to help heal these people who are very deeply damaged by a lot of experiences growing up in a way that demonstrates them love of God as opposed to, you know, throwing the Bible at them and saying, you know, a lot of what they're disordered and going to hell. And all of the, so many people, these beautiful, innocent people, have lost their faith. So the hope is that people can get to discuss it from their perspective, understand it from a much deeper level. And it really is about that deep level reflection, so people can really go back into their workplace, go back into the, you know, to the groups of people that they love, and be able to talk with much more confidence and understanding about the issues around same-sex attraction.
Paul Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Paul Martin of the Centre for Human Potential will be at the Oasis Centre in Surry Hills this coming week, Thursday the 26th, Understanding Sexual Diversity, a workshop if you want to get along. We'll put the details up on our website. Paul, thanks once again. We hope to catch up with you again soon.
Thank you, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.